From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Trump administration has made two big moves on Obamacare this week. Late yesterday, the White House announced it will end subsidies to health insurance companies that help low-income people pay for health care coverage. And earlier in the day, the president signed an executive order to allow cheaper, less regulated plans to be sold. Julie Rovner is chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She joins us now. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Jeremy.
So let's start with the latest news on the subsidies. Just explain what exactly is going on here.
Well, there's two kinds of subsidies. There's people get help paying their premiums, and that goes up to 400% of poverty. Then people who earn up to 250% of poverty, that's about $30,000 for an individual, get help paying their out-of-pocket costs, their deductibles and other cost-sharing. There's been a legal fight about whether Congress formally appropriated the money for that second type of subsidy, and that's what the president said that he wouldn't pay anymore last night. Now, the insurers still have to give the subsidies to those moderate income people, but now the federal government says they won't pay the insurance companies back.
And what's the argument for that? Why not pay the insurance companies back?
Well, this is a very technical legal argument about whether or not the money was actually formally appropriated by Congress. The House sued the Obama administration. A judge actually sided with the House, but then she stayed her ruling pending an appeal. The appeal is still out there. It's been on delay while Congress figured out if it was going to repeal and replace the whole law. And, you know, last night at almost 11 o'clock at night, the administration said, we've decided we can't legally pay these anymore, so we're not going to. Now, Trump has been threatening to do this since February.
Right. But what are the consequences of it now that he's done it?
Well, the consequences of it are now the insurance companies are holding the bag. They still are required by the law to provide these discounts to people. They can increase premiums to cover the losses for next year, and most of them are doing so, which is why premiums coming up for the open enrollment are expected to be at least 20% higher. It's unclear what happens to the rest of the money that they're owed this year. And, of course, you know, people who get help paying their premiums won't really feel these increases because their subsidies will go up. The people who are getting hammered are the people who don't get help from the government to pay their premiums, have to pay these entire increases themselves.
Does it mean anything for people, the vast majority of Americans, who get their health insurance through work?
No, it really doesn't. The individual market is about somewhere in the neighborhood of 17, 18 million people. That's a lot of people, but obviously there's 330 million Americans. Most of them, as you point out, get their insurance through work or through the Medicare or Medicaid programs or other government programs. This is not part of that. This only has to do with people who are in that individual market.
What about the executive order yesterday related to selling plans across state lines? What's the impact of that?
Well, the immediate impact is nothing. What actually the executive order did is it ordered the agencies that handle health policy, which are Health and Human Services, Labor, and Treasury, to look at whether or not to put out regulations or guidance that could make other kinds of health plans that are not allowed now under the Affordable Care Act more available. But that's going to go through the regular, rulemaking process, which could be many months if it happens at all. It's not entirely clear which of these things the administration has legal authority to do on its own and which of them would actually need legislation.
Julie, what does all this mean for the future of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, which, as we know, President Trump wanted to have repealed and replaced, and his Republican Congress couldn't make it happen?
Well, it's pretty clear that he's trying to cause as much chaos as possible in an effort to force, I guess, Democrats and maybe Republicans back to the bargaining table. These two things were clearly timed. We're a couple of weeks away from the beginning of open enrollment for next year. After all these predictions, there are, in fact, health plans in every single county in the nation. Now they could drop out because of the failure to the cancellation of these subsidies. So we might actually see places where there are no plans available. But I think he wants to, you know, he keeps saying it's imploding, and when it didn't implode, he kind of is going in to try to make it implode. And he says because he wants to come up with something different, but Congress has proved pretty much that if they can think of something different, they can't find enough votes to pass it.
Do you expect him to issue more executive orders like this that many people see as an attempt to sabotage Obamacare?
It's hard to know. Someone was just asking, you know, what could be next? They're already doing a lot to make it harder for people to sign up. They've cut the funding for outreach. They've cut the funding for people who help people sign up. They're going to take down the website, you know, almost every Sunday for the entirety of the open enrollment, which is only half as long as last year. So they're already doing quite a lot to try to deter people from signing up. I'm sure they may think of other things, though.
That's Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Well, as expected, President Trump announced today that he is not certifying the Iran nuclear deal. Now, certification has to be done every 90 days. If it's not, the deal is kicked to Congress, and the president laid out steps that he thinks should be taken to punish Iran for what he says was not living up to the spirit of the nuclear deal. Jim Walsh is here now, security analyst and a senior research associate at MIT's Security Studies program. He's in the studio. And Jim, your thoughts on this. And to remind people, the deal essentially was that Iran would give up its nuclear weapons-making capability and agree to provisions like inspections in exchange. Some sanctions regarding the weapons would be lifted. So that was the deal. The president says Iran violated it.
Well, he said it violated the spirit of the deal. As far as I know of no international treaty that has a section called the spirit of the deal. The deal is the deal. The language is the language, and either you're complying or you're not.
Well, the president, let's see, he said that Iran has exceeded the limit of tons of heavy water, failed to meet expectations on centrifuges, intimidated inspectors, didn't allow them on military sites.
So let's be clear here. His own intelligence community is telling him Iran is complying with the deal. The International Atomic Energy Agency is telling him Iran is complying with the deal. And last night, in a briefing provided by Secretary of State Tillerson and National Security Advisor McMaster, what did they say? They said Iran is complying with the deal. He's not decertifying them based on compliance with the nuclear agreement. He's saying the agreement is not in America's national security interest. That is his justification. But it's not on compliance. The administration has been, other than him, has been quite clear that they are in, quote, technical compliance, which is another word for compliance.
Well, so what's going on here? Because he listed steps that he thinks should be taken, including, you know, imposing new sanctions that will address Iran's Islamic Guard, you know, Revolutionary Guard. This is the core guard. How do you impose new sanctions? Is that outside the deal?
Is all outside the deal. And in fact, they're not even actually really doing that. They've been threatening to impose broad sanctions on the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. But like every president before him, the conclusion was if we do that, that will put the military servicemen and women in the region fighting ISIS at risk. And so they've decided not to do that and sort of go with a watered-down version. But let me be clear about this because it's easy to be confused. There are really two separate things here. Mm-hmm. One is the deal itself that was negotiated by seven governments, including our allies, and the UN Security Council resolution that endorsed it. That is not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is a piece of legislation that Congress passed after the deal.
Well, let's be clear, because I love where you're going. But we are talking about it in the sense that that's what has to be recertified every 90 days, the agreement that was laid out by these countries.
The U.S. Congress did was pass a law that said, Mr. President, whoever you are, you should certify. If you don't certify, Congress has 60 days to impose new sanctions.
Right.
And if they impose new sanctions, certainly under a situation where Iran is complying, then guess what? We're the ones who are violating the deal. And, you know, you break it, you own it. We will get blamed for it.
Well, but the second thing, as you say, that the president has been talking about today, this wish list of things he'd like to see that have nothing to do with the deal that was hammered out by, you know, several countries. This is legislation that was sponsored. It's a bill sponsored by Senators Bob Corker of Tennessee and Tom Cotton of Arkansas. What's in that bill?
Well, there are a variety of things here. So the president is certainly at liberty to go after Iran on things that are not in the Iran deal. And as I've always said, if you don't like Iran, what Iran does, the last thing you want is an Iran that does things you don't like with nuclear weapons. So the deal is supposed to prevent nuclear weapons. So if he wants to go after other pieces of what Iran's behavior, he's within his rights to do that. But in this bill, essentially Congress is seeking to unilaterally renegotiate an international agreement by setting new deadlines and new requirements and saying if you don't do this or don't renegotiate the deal to include these new provisions, then we're going to impose sanctions. Well, if they do that, the U.S. will be found in violation of the deal.
Well, and as we heard the BBC's Lise Doucette say, can Iran then say, okay, fine, you violated the deal. Give us back all of our weapons-making material that we gave up as part of the deal.
Yeah, I think it's actually worse than that. Essentially, it's a great gift to Iran if we break the deal, because we get blamed. They get tremendous freedom of movement. They can gin up their centrifuges if they want. They can deploy new, more efficient centrifuges, or they can just make side deals with the Europeans, who are very unhappy. I mean, essentially, America First is turning into America Alone because we keep doing things and walking away from our commitments.
But just in the few seconds we have, people have also said this sends a signal to North Korea. Why should they bother to negotiate a deal to give up their weapons because they're watching what's happening here? But should there be concerns about Iran?
Well, sure, of course. But we have lots of policy tools to deal with that. The last thing we want to do is get – they're in a box. Their nuclear program is in a box. Why would we open that box? We're creating confusion and uncertainty, and our allies don't know what we're doing, and they think America won't keep its promises. And all this is – we're doing it to ourselves. We have plenty to deal with without all this.
Jim Walsh, here now, security analyst, a senior research associate at MIT Security Studies Program. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you.
At least 31 people have died from the wildfires that are still burning across Northern California. In a chilling detail, officials are identifying some of the charred remains by the serial numbers on medical devices like hip replacements. Some people who took refuge in backyard pools survived. At least one woman did not. She was suffocated by smoke and died in her husband's arms. Firefighters have been working for days on the more than 20 fires in the state that cover 300 square miles, but the fires are far from contained, and winds are expected to rise again tonight. We want to check back in Santa Rosa, where 3,000 homes have been destroyed. Chris Rogers is a city councilman for Santa Rosa. He's standing watch at his home about a half mile from the evacuation zone. Councilman Rogers, still a half mile away, you're watching flames, breathing smoke. What's going on?
You hit the nail on the head when you mentioned the weather. I think everybody is quickly becoming a weather expert in Santa Rosa, figuring out how the wind is going to affect this fire and has affected this fire over the last 5 days. And just everybody is nervous, but also pulling together as a community to make sure that we're taking care of one another.
Well, we hear you ran into a burning home to save mementos.
Well, so we actually were trying to dispel a rumor. There's an area of town called Oakmont. It's about 3,000 homes. We've been hearing that the entire thing had burnt to the ground. So myself, Senator Mike McGuire, the Chief of Staff Jason Lyles, and our CHP captain went out so that we could say publicly, we have seen that that has not happened. When we got there, there was one particular home that had just started to catch on fire, and it happened to be Susan Gorin, a Sonoma County supervisor's home. So as we spoke to Susan, she explained to us where the keys to her car were, where her jewelry and her mementos were, threw them in the car and got out of there before there was any real threat to us at the home.
Listen, we're hearing incredible stories about, in Bodega Bay, restaurants opening and 300 people sleeping in them. You mentioned a CHP, a California Highway Patrol officer. They're taking in relatives and evacuees in their offices. One says, this is Officer Shock says, it's like a refugee camp in my office. Give me a sense of some other scenes that you're seeing.
One of the questions I keep getting over and over again from people is, who's helping the people who are helping us? Who is taking care of the firefighters and the police officers and the city staff who have also lost their homes but yet continue to push forward to make sure that we still have a Santa Rosa? And there were a group of retired firefighters with the International Association of Firefighters who had come up specifically to begin the process of accessing services for those firefighters as well, to make sure that they can focus on fighting the fire. And then when they are done, they'll already have the process started of getting their FEMA grants and their insurance all in order. But things are better today than they were yesterday, and I'm sure things will be better tomorrow than they are today.
Well, boy, that's a glass half full, and I'm sure appreciated there because you have to. We've been speaking to people from your community. I mean, whole neighborhoods are gone. We spoke to a public radio colleague guarding his home. He's so afraid your town's not going to come back. I mean, your schools and major stores, and just the devastation has been terrible. And then the human loss. Now, do I understand that a member of your extended family is among the dead?
Yeah, unfortunately, my sister-in-law's aunt was identified yesterday. She'd been missing since the blaze occurred, and just so devastating for her and for her family. But, you know, we're going to fight this as a community. The idea that Santa Rosa isn't going to come back has never entered into the minds of anybody who's lived here. And I was born in Santa Rosa and have spent my whole life here, and it is an incredible community. So we'll get through this together. The first thing that we have to do, though, is finish controlling the blaze.
It sounds like an incredible effort on the part of everyone, especially, I mean, we, you know, these firefighters and other officials like yourself are around the clock. You know, what is your biggest concern right now?
Making sure that the public understands what's happening and making sure that they have accurate information. When's their gas going to be back on? Why can't they go back into their home if they lived in an evacuation zone? Whether you have an official role in the emergency operations or not, I think the focus is trying to be useful and not being in the way of the professionals.
Yeah. But here you went to knock down a rumor about fires in a certain neighborhood, and you found a fire.
You know, but that's also not unique. I think when all is said and done, when this settles down, you'll have hundreds of stories from people who helped their neighbors in exactly the same way. You know, we went to take food out to some of the firefighters on the front line, and every single one of them said, "Oh God, we've got way too much food already. Oh wait, it's tri-tip, we'll take it." Right? So things like that. It has been a pretty incredible effort.
Are you, I mean, again, you're really, you've got a terrifically optimistic view here. But as we said, winds are going to pick up, no rain in the forecast, no way of containing these fires without some help from nature. The worst case scenario, are you not worried about losing so much more?
I mean, of course we're worried. But one of the things that has been happening over the last couple of days has been prep work for what could happen. For instance, when the wind had died down a little bit, the firefighters were able to light some backfires to help block off certain areas of the city in case the winds pick back up. They've been able to use bulldozers to create fire breaks in some areas to make it more difficult for the fire to travel. So they've been able to do a lot of prep work that if the winds do pick up here in the next 24 hours, yes, it's unpredictable, but it makes it easier for the firefighters to react.
Yeah. That's Chris Rogers, city councilman for Santa Rosa, at his home, watching warily the flames and the winds. Chris, thank you so much, and best of luck to you.
All right, take care.
Well, as we've been saying, there's little cell phone or internet service across Sonoma County, so people can't get news. But Santa Rosa radio station KZST has become something of a lifeline. This pop and classic rock station transformed into an essential news source. Nina Ginsler-Debs of KALW visited KZST and filed this report.
Early Monday morning, KZST owner Gordon's Lot was sure his station was about to burn to the ground. He could see flames just a few feet from the building.
We've been here for almost 35 years, and this is my whole life right here. I was fully prepared to walk away and have the building be in ashes.
Employees were advised to evacuate Monday morning, but came back to save what they could. They fought encroaching flames with their own fire extinguishers until the fire department finally arrived and put them out. Once the station was saved, then the team at KZST really got to work.
The weather has changed from yesterday. The red flag warning was lifted this morning, so the overcast...
Starting about midday on Monday, KZST and their four affiliate stations cut all their normal programming, including their ads. They've been airing nothing but live coverage of the Northern California wildfires around the clock.
Southerly winds this afternoon, another wind event expected tomorrow and on into Thursday.
It's been really difficult to get reliable, updated information here in Santa Rosa. Many people don't have internet. Cell service is down in parts of the area, as is TV access. So for some Sonoma County residents, radio is all they have.
Yes. I'm double-checking. Are we evacuating in Geyserville?
Yes, when I walk into the studios on Tuesday evening, all the cubicles are dark, the offices empty. Everyone who's here is either in studio recording or darting in and out to bring information to the on-air hosts. An engineer runs around, desperately trying to fix equipment.
Kite string and paper clips, whatever it takes to get, you know, a phone line running.
Creative director Karen Lehman is right outside the studio, taking a much-needed break.
And so when something horrific happens, it's all hands on deck. Anybody that can get here safely gets here.
And it truly has been all hands on deck.
If you are up on the hills in Bennett Valley, you need to be evacuating. I know you don't want to lose your home. Nobody would want to, but life over property.
Frank Colbertus is the station's regional sales manager. On airtime is not part of his job description. But today, he's been live for hours, giving out his personal cell phone to anyone who has information to share or a question they need answered.
843-816-7253 is my text if you've got information. 387.
That loud buzzing noise you hear under Colbertus, that's a fan. It smells pretty smoky in the studio.
Thank goodness to Eric who just got the fan going in here because it's been amazingly hot. We're running off a generator, so obviously the air conditioning.
Much of the information is coming from listeners texting or calling to share what they're seeing or experiencing.
Shiloh and Flott Road is a controlled burn. This is confirmed.
Yes.
And it's pretty much out. There's not much smoke now at all.
Darren McCormick is an afternoon host and just one of many Santa Rosa residents whose home is in an evacuation zone. In fact, he learned the news only a few minutes before sitting down with me.
This has been a nightmare. I was saying earlier when I first came on the air, I said, can I wake up now?
And even though the fires are still nowhere near fully contained, station owner Gordon Zlot says we need to think ahead.
Well, I think we've learned that we really weren't prepared. Not only we, but I think all of California. If we had the big earthquake, you know, you're not going to have cell, you're not going to have power, you're not going to have the internet, you're not going to have television, you won't have anything. What do you do? Now, you might have the radio, and that's where we come in.
Wednesday morning, KZST's generator failed, and they scrambled to find another backup power source. But they were only off air for about an hour and a half before staffers were back on the mic. And they tell me they'll be here, not knowing when they'll get to sign off.
Colbertus, we're going to be with you throughout the evening and as long as we need to be to keep
for here and now. I'm Nina Gensler Debs in Santa Rosa.
And congrats to our colleagues in radio. They're in times of need.
Here in Boston, fans expect a lot. A lot from their teams, and a lot from the reporters who cover them. I'm Boston Globe sports columnist Chris Gasper. I'm working with WBUR to bring you a new daily podcast, Season Ticket. I'll take fans with me for a behind-the-scenes look, from the press box to the locker room and beyond. Season Ticket, available at wbur.org/seasonticket or wherever you get your podcasts. Funding provided by Zip, the smartest way to hire.
President Trump could soon announce who he will appoint to run the Federal Reserve. Current Fed Chair Janet Yellen's term expires in February, but Trump has the option to reappoint her to a second term. Yesterday, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin spoke to CNBC, and he was asked about who the president might choose.
There's been no decisions made, and it would be inappropriate for me to comment on any of the people that are being considered one way or another. You know, this is something that the president is focused on, trying to make a decision in the next month, although we don't have a specific deadline.
Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News and joins us from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So, first of all, do we know who is being talked about as the possible next head of the Federal Reserve?
Well, there are a few names being bannered around and several people who have come in for interviews. I like to sort of track this in the predictions market of all places, a website predictit.com, which gives you the probability of each potential Fed chair based on betting markets, basically. And the front runner, according to that site right now, is Jerome Powell, who is a current governor of the Federal Reserve. And he's got about a 39% probability. But this number bounces around a lot. And some of the other contenders who have been front runners include Kevin Warsh, another former Fed governor, and Stanford economist John Taylor, who hasn't worked for the Fed, but he worked for the Treasury, and he's been very influential to Fed policymakers for something called the Taylor Rule, which is basically a mathematical formula that suggests where the Fed should set interest rates. But the White House has kept this very close to the vest, and it's really anyone's guess, I think, at this point.
Would any of those people signal a big change in Fed policy if they were to be selected?
Well, there's two main considerations you have to look at. There's monetary policy, which is the setting of interest rates and how they unwind the stimulus efforts that they undertook during the financial crisis. And then there's regulation, how they view the Fed's role on regulating the nation's banks. And none of the candidates really tick off what are presumed to be Trump's preferences on both issues. The closest who comes to it is probably Gary Cohn, but his prospects really have dimmed since the Charlottesville incident. There was a lot in the press about his reaction to how President Trump handled that situation. So certainly whoever it is will have a big effect, but it's just not clear exactly who's going to tick off all those boxes that President Trump would like.
Gary Cohn currently serving as the director of the National Economic Council.
Right.
Is there any chance that Janet Yellen will stay as Fed chair?
I don't think it's a complete impossibility. Again, in those prediction markets, her current odds are very low, about 13% probability. And the main reason is, obviously, President Trump has liked to undo as much of the Obama legacy as he can. And since Yellen was appointed by Obama, a lot of people feel that there's no way he'll keep her just because of that simple fact. And Trump also has obviously expressed a preference for people with real-world business experience. And Janet Yellen is very much an academic at heart. So I don't think it's impossible that she'll get renominated, but it's looking doubtful based on the surveys and these prediction markets.
That's Michael Regan, a senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
It's been more than 3 weeks since Hurricane Maria trashed Puerto Rico, and still only 16% of residents have electricity, according to the Department of Defense, although 64% have water. Today, President Trump tweeted out the wonderful people of Puerto Rico with their unmatched spirit. Know how bad things were before the H's, meaning the hurricanes. I will always be with them. Well, perhaps that was in response to the backlash to his tweet yesterday, in which he said, we cannot keep FEMA, the military, and first responders who've been amazing under the most difficult circumstances in Puerto Rico forever, implying he was going to pull out his assistance. So what's going on, and how is this being received? WBUR's Simon Rios has been traveling the island with Puerto Ricans from mainland U.S. who are helping with the relief effort. We'll link you to his reporting at hereandnow.org. It's terrific. And Simon joins us from San Juan. Simon, one of the places you visited, Punta Santiago, a fishing village on the water. What did you see there?
Well, Robin, we've traveled all over sort of the north and the southeast of Puerto Rico, and this was by far the worst hit area. It's a town that's bordered by the ocean on one side and a channel on the other. So when flooding happens, the water has nowhere to go but into the neighborhoods. People who have houses built of cement and cinder blocks made out relatively well, but those who have wooden houses, in some cases, there's no longer any sign the houses even stood there once. We spoke to one woman who was sitting outside a house that was totally ruined. She was trying to salvage some silverware, which was one of the only things she had left. Her house was gone. You know, we also heard all kinds of stories. We heard about a local man who had gotten cut on his legs by zinc roofing material during the hurricane. Help didn't arrive in time, and his wounds were infected, and both legs had to be amputated. Mm. You know, Robin, we think about disasters in terms of death counts and monetary damage, but the suffering of the people is what's most striking on the ground, and everybody in Puerto Rico has lost something, if not everything.
Well, you covered Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, and you say this is reminding you of the devastation you saw in the lower Ninth Ward. So talk about what people are seeing. Are they seeing government presence? Are you seeing government presence?
Not so much. I ask this question everywhere we go. Who's been through here? What have you seen? And with the exception of military helicopters flying through the sky, we saw literally no government presence in any of the places we went. This isn't to say that officials haven't come through, but there seems to be no lasting presence, at least in the places we visited. So, you know, it's falling to the people themselves, as well as nonprofit organizations, like one we visited in Punta Santiago called Peces. And, you know, it's a sort of economic development and educational nonprofit, but now their entire focus has shifted to relief work. Sister Nancy Madden is from the United States, a former Catholic nun. She's the founder of Peces in Punta Santiago.
This was one of the most severely traumatic experiences anybody could live, and practically the whole island lived it, you know. Help has to be ongoing. It's not going to help to have water for one day and not have water for the next week. It's not going to help to have food for one day and not have it for the next week. It's not going to help if you lost your job and you can't find another job.
Well, so that brings us to, you know, what's sort of brewing over the president's comments, seeming to imply that he's going to pull support from Puerto Rico and that the problems were largely theirs. Everybody knows Puerto Rico has huge debt, you know, was in financial crisis before this happened. But what are people saying to you about his tweets?
I asked several people about this, and, you know, the most common response was to just sort of smirk and shake your head and brush it off. It doesn't seem to be people's top concern here in Puerto Rico. But, you know, I talked to one San Juanero, a bartender, who said that Puerto Rico is being treated as second class because, for one, they're not a state, and for two, they're Latino. They speak Spanish. Another person I talked to was William Medina, who lives in San Juan, and he has a different take.
If we're a state or not, that's a political issue. As far as citizenship, we are American citizens like anybody else in the United States, and we are supposed to be treated equally. Regardless of Chinese heritage or Latin heritage or whatever, we are who we are, and we are American citizens.
And Medina points out that Puerto Rico never asked to become a colony of the United States, which many people believe is the case. And Puerto Ricans have been citizens since before World War I. And Medina thinks that that's not a coincidence, that the United States has always wanted Puerto Ricans to fight in its wars.
That's WBUR Simon Rios from San Juan. Simon, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Well, now to the Great Lakes region. For a reminder of how America's past intersects with the present, more than 150 years ago, the region played a key role in the Underground Railroad, runaway slaves making their way to cities along the lakes and then crossing the border to freedom in Canada. Fast forward to today, thousands of asylum seekers who came to live in the U.S. follow a similar route north to Canada because they no longer feel welcome in the U.S. Angelica Morrison of Great Lakes Today has more.
An Amtrak train pulls into the Niagara Falls, New York station. It's just a few miles away from the famous falls, and it's also the spot where abolitionist Harriet Tubman helped runaway slaves cross the bridge to Canada.
The U.S. and Canadian border was the difference between oppression and freedom.
That's Sarah Capon, the executive director for the Niagara Falls National Heritage Area. Capon points to a map of the region inside the station. Her finger lands on the Niagara River. It runs from Lake Erie to Lake Ontario.
If you were journeying and you looked at just the geography alone, you weren't likely to cross Lake Ontario. Perhaps Lake Erie in spots, certainly Buffalo area, but the Niagara River was narrow, and it was that you're easiest and most accessible way to be able to get to Canada.
Today, thousands of people are using similar routes to cross the border, and many are asylum seekers. They're people who came to the U.S. and can't go back to their home country for various reasons, like religious or political persecution, so they ask for protection in another country.
So Monday morning, he needs to be ready by 6:30.
At a Buffalo shelter for asylum seekers called Vive, Mariah Walker speaks through a translator on speakerphone. She's a Canadian services manager, and they're helping a man from Turkey prepare for his interview at the Canadian border. Buffalo is another location where slaves were ferried to Canada.
Okay,
Bey. Mustafa Bey, pazartesi sabah 6:30'da taksi sizi almaya gelecek. O saatte eşyalarınızla hazır olmanız gerekiyor.
Peki.
The man didn't want to be named or share the details of his situation, but he did say he chose to seek asylum in Canada instead of the U.S. Many people are making the same choice, says Anna Ireland Mongo, the chief program officer for the organization that operates Vive. She cites two reasons. One, the hostile political climate towards immigrants, and President Donald Trump's travel ban.
At that particular point in time, like, people really did not feel safe in the U.S. And I think the fear level of people coming through their building and their desperation to get out or their desperation to claim asylum really increased.
Last year, Vive helped about 1,500 people in the U.S. claim asylum in Canada. The pace has quickened this year, and they're up to about 1,300 so far. People who cross into Canada from the Great Lakes region enter the province of Ontario. Last year, the Canadian Border Services Agency counted about 4,000 asylum seekers who entered Ontario through land crossings. And so far this year, they've counted close to 3,000. The trend is the same in the Quebec area. In fact, the crowds are so big that officials have used parts of an Olympic stadium in Montreal as a temporary shelter. Further west is Detroit, Michigan, where TJ Rogers is the program manager for the Freedom House. It's another shelter that helps people claiming asylum. He sees similarities between the Underground Railroad and today's rush of asylum seekers.
In the general sense of, you know, what the Underground Railroad represented and the idea of moving north and how it represented freedom, I think that's absolutely the case.
He says the Freedom House is also seeing more and more people expressing interest in going to Canada. And in Detroit, like Niagara Falls and Buffalo, it's just a short trip across the river. For Here and Now, I'm Angelica Morrison.
It's Here and Now. And I'm sorry if when I said it's here and now, your iPhone thought I was saying, hey, Siri, and activated its microphone. Happens all the time. That's called a wake word. And Google got into some trouble this week because its new device, the Google Home Mini, was recording users even when they didn't purposely wake up their device. Ben Johnson covers tech for Here and Now. He joins us now in the studio. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
And for those who don't have these smart speakers at home, whether it's Alexa or Google Home,
yeah,
how are they supposed to work?
So most of these speakers, much like your phone, work by you talking to them, giving commands and asking questions. But in the case of the Home Mini, as it's being called, there's also a button on the top that lets you activate the speaker to listen, lets you pause music, stop an alarm, something like that. And a few of the people who got these speakers early, they were just announced earlier this month, noticed that the speaker was recording them randomly without them wanting it to because of a design flaw that made the speaker think the button had been pressed. Usually Google's or Amazon's smart speaker and virtual assistant, Alexa, or even Apple Siri, will only listen, record, and send information to company servers if someone uses what you've described, one of these things called wake words or wake phrases.
Well, let's demonstrate, by the way, because you've got your phone there in front of you.
So, yeah, I do. I've broken the cardinal rule of bringing the phone into the studio.
Yep.
But just to give a quick example, so if I say Google, nothing happens, right? But if I say, okay, Google, who is Jeremy Hobson?
According to Wikipedia, Jeremy Hobson is an American national radio journalist.
So you notice there, right?
Like, see, Siri never knows these things, but yes.
So you notice there, right, that there's actually a specific phrase that I say to wake this thing up. And this is kind of interesting. It takes a minute to understand because it's a little strange. The system kind of listens on two levels. So in a passive way, it listens for a specific phrase. And then once you say that phrase, that's when the system really wakes up, so to speak, and starts listening. If we use Apple Siri to do this or on an Android phone, we actually do this all the time, right? People are used to this at this point.
So has Google fixed the problem with the Google Home Mini?
So in the case of the Home Mini, which is widely available on October 19th. We should say that out loud. It's about $50. Google fixed the problem by disabling the button with a software update. And the company announced that over privacy concerns, it was going to permanently remove the functionality of the Home Mini Speaker button. And that's kind of a big move. It kind of reflects just how nervous the company is about making us nervous as users when it comes to our privacy.
I have to say, in the last couple of weeks, I have had two friends come up to me and say, I was at home, I was having a conversation, we had one of these devices, not a Home Mini, but something else.
Yeah.
And then 2 days later, I get an ad somewhere when I go online about what we were talking about in the house. It really does make you wonder if they are already listening more than they should be.
Right. Well, the way Google's engineers have described this, listening to me, it is kind of interesting. Like I said, it's listening at these two levels. Now, the analogy I've come up with for that, just to clarify this a little bit even more, is think about the way that when you listen. So imagine you're in a coffee shop and you're waiting for your fancy coffee drink, but you're working away on your laptop. You hear the conversation around you, but you're not really listening for content. And then someone says, Jeremy? And then you sort of wake up, you hear this alarm, and you say, okay, now I need to pay attention to what's going on here. Again, this is what Google engineers have described to me in terms of how the machine and the system listens. This question of listening to pull data and deliver advertisements is a really important one, and it's one that people have been talking a lot about. This has happened to me before. I've been talking about something and then started to Google it, and it auto-completes faster than I would have expected. Now, again, the company says that they're very, very careful about when they pull data, permissions in these kinds of apps and these devices. So I think the company line here is it's not doing that. It's not listening to you when you don't ask it to listen to you and then delivering ads. But we can't help but have those feelings sometimes. And it's part of this kind of weird smart home, something always on and connected to the internet feeling that we have these days.
But you're saying that also sometimes maybe you say something that might wake it up and that makes it start to listen.
Yeah, that's a possibility. So, I asked the folks at Google Assistant about this, and they said essentially, look, you might inadvertently wake it up for a certain period of time, but then it goes back to sleep. So they are very careful about thinking of this stuff. And I think they're really nervous about freaking regular users out. So they're really careful with how they build these things.
That's the first rule of tech support, is always say it's the humans that are making the mistake. I don't know
it's
if
true.
I buy it.
It's true. And it's an interesting time, right? Earlier this year, we had the first case of Amazon Alexa data being asked for by the authorities in this murder case in Arkansas. And Amazon at first used this First Amendment argument to say, no, it's free speech, you can't have the data, but eventually handed it over. So it is something that all of us as users should be thinking about as we think about the things that we're putting in our home and connecting to the internet.
That's Ben Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Ben, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And Alexa, Siri, and Google, please erase everything that you've heard in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah,
we weren't talking about you. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.